The Second Empire. Italian and German unification between 1859 and 1871 was a disaster for Europe's small states, 12 of which lost their independence. The Habsburgs were compelled to grant Hungary equal political status, creating the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary in 1867. This failed to resolve whether this was still an empire or a personal union, with the Habsburgs continuing the early modern fudge already characteristic in their adoption of a hereditary imperial title in 1804. It proved difficult to decide when Austrian history began. Actual separation from Germany sprang from the defeat of 1866, which hardly offered a suitably patriotic starting point. Consequently, Austrian history only became a compulsory subject at the country's universities in 1893, when it adopted the wider scholarly convention of tracing the country's development as part of wider imperial history, Reichsgeschichte, until the reign of Charles V, when Habsburg emperors subtly morphed into good Austrians who dealt with the empire almost as if it was a separate, fairly minor country. Prussia's victory over France in 1870-1871 allowed it to convert the expedient of the North German Confederation into the Second Empire by absorbing the South German states of Baden, Bavaria, Hessen-Darmstadt, and Württemberg. The new empire was proclaimed on the 18th of January 1871 in the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles, in a ceremony staged deliberately not only to demonstrate victory over France, but to echo selected elements of the Holy Roman past in an effort to base the new state on something broader than military triumph. Otto von Bismarck persuaded Ludwig II of Bavaria to lead the surviving German princes to acclaim Wilhelm I as emperor in an act drawing directly on what was believed to be early medieval practice. The proclamation explicitly referred to the German imperial title dormant for over 60 years. Holy Roman connections continued as Wilhelm sat on the Ottonian Goslar throne, rather than his royal Prussian one, when he opened the new Reichstag on the 21st of March. The early modern formulation Emperor and Empire, Kaiser und Reich, was also used to accommodate the fact that the Second Empire consisted of a much enlarged Prussia, itself still a kingdom, 21 kingdoms and principalities, and 3 free cities. These actions derived from expediency rather than genuine commitment to the Holy Roman past. The Goslar throne was used because the Habsburgs still held the Aachen treasures and imperial insignia. Bismarck needed to mask the fact that creating the Second Empire had involved severing historic ties to Austria, suppressing 6 sovereign German states, and asserting Prussian dominance over the remainder. A vague association with the earlier imperial title avoided calling Wilhelm I federal president, which sounded dangerously republican after the experiences of 1848. The interim imperial coat of arms, devised for January 1871, used the Prussian eagle with a shield emblazoned with Hohenzollern devices underneath Charlemagne's crown. The latter appeared on the 1871 commemorative medal and on major historical monuments built between the 1870s and 1890s to evoke a common German past. But it was embarrassing that the real crown was still in the Habsburg treasury. New official arms were soon devised, combining a fantasy crown with the Prussian Order of the Black Eagle. Prussian traditions became clearer when Wilhelm I's son, Frederick, numbered himself 3rd at his succession in 1888, following the sequence from Frederick II, the Great, rather than the 15th century emperor, Frederick III. The popular historian Gustav Freytag had already written in 1870 that a new emperor should wear an army officer's helmet and coat, not an imperial crown and robes. And indeed, Anton von Werner's famous 1885 painting of the January 1871 ceremony shows the assembled German royalty dressed in military uniforms. After 1871, Holy Roman traditions were discarded in favor of a romanticized medieval German past that existed in artificial detachment from its actual historical context. The Thuringian poet Friedrich Ruckert had popularized the local Kyffhäuser legend that Emperor Barbarossa had been sleeping under a mountain until Germany was reborn. The story attracted growing attention after it appeared in the second part of the Grimm Brothers folktale collection in 1817. This chimed with romantic ideas of rebirth that were popular in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars. Meanwhile, Friedrich Raumer began what became a six-volume history of the Stauffers under the immediate influence of Francis's abdication in 1806. Raumer presented the Stauffers as a dramatic story of rise and fall, cementing the popular view of them as representing the last age of German greatness. Subsequent governments invoked the Stauffers to suggest the birth of a new Germany. Barbarossa was the name chosen for the first flagship of the new Federal Navy, established by the Frankfurt Parliament in 1848. The elderly Wilhelm I was already dubbed Barba Blanca, Whitebeard, at his acclamation in 1871. Veterans from the wars of 1866 and 1871 petitioned to erect a national monument at Kyffhäuser. As soon as scholars pronounced that the mountain had once been sacred to Wotan, the idea seemed doubly appropriate, and the new emperor, Wilhelm II, laid the foundation stone in 1892. The grandiose structure was formally inaugurated on the 18th of June 1896, with a march past of 30,000 veterans. It combines an equestrian statue of Wilhelm I with a second showing Barbarossa waking at the foot of the plinth. Ruckert's poem remained on the school curriculum into the 20th century. Meanwhile, the decaying Goslar Imperial Palace was restored as a national monument between 1868 and 1897 and decorated with paintings depicting selected aspects of imperial history, including the waking Barbarossa. Otherwise, national monuments were not built at sites associated with the Holy Roman Empire, but at ahistorical locations, like the junction of the Moselle and Rhine, which was dubbed the German Corner, Deutsches Eck, and adorned in 1897 with another grandiose monument to Wilhelm I. A huge statue of Germania was constructed between 1871 and 1883 outside Rudesheim on the Rhine, to present the Second Empire as cementing German unity. The 500 Bismarck Towers, built across Germany from 1900 to 1910, celebrating that statesman, were modeled on Theodoric's tomb at Ravenna to claim a common Gothic past. Meanwhile, the Hanseatic League was reinvented as a purely German enterprise to lend legitimacy to Wilhelmine naval and colonial policy. The Empire and the German Problem. Both Austria-Hungary and the Second Empire collapsed at the end of the First World War, as revolutions forced all German monarchs to abdicate. Both empires had been successful in many respects, especially Germany, which had become the world's fourth largest economy by 1914. Their imperialism was contemporary, a product of the highly competitive environment of the late 19th century world, rather than the pre-1806 imperial past. Neither empire solved the question of belonging. Official policy in Austria-Hungary had continued to place dynastic loyalty above local or national identity, inadvertently creating a situation similar to that in earlier 19th century Germany, as nationalism became an ideology of those opposed to the government. Austria-Hungary was broken up in the Versailles Settlement of 1919, which left Austria as a small republic shorn of empire. Even with the Habsburgs gone, it proved difficult to to historicize the imperial past. Conservative writers tried to claim it as a civilizing mission, to allow Austria to escape its much-reduced frontiers by suggesting that the country might once again provide order for an otherwise fragmented and chaotic Central Europe. Hugo Hansch emphasized Catholicism as a unifying element, while Heinrich Ritter von Srbik stressed a common Germantum, though without racial overtones. Friedrich Heer did both in his romanticized presentation of the empire as a benign force. Imperial Germany's initial toleration of multi-layered identities angered those who felt that the process of unification had not gone far enough in 1871. A variety of groups agitated for a more homogeneous cultural identity and for the incorporation of German speakers still outside the empire. The declaration of German as the state language throughout Prussia proved counterproductive, stirring a Polish nationalist backlash. The targeting of Catholics, Jews, and socialists as unpatriotic was equally divisive. Disagreement over German nationality was one of many factors undermining the Weimar Republic, established amidst revolution and civil war in 1919. Article 127 of the Weimar Constitution provided communal autonomy and self-regulation within a wider legal framework, drawing directly on historical studies of communal forms in the Holy Roman Empire and broader German past. However, many rejected republican government as un-German, regarding the Weimar regime as another interregnum like 1250 to 1273. Again, it seemed that a weakened and divided Germany was waiting for its Barbarossa to awake and provide leadership. A new generation of historians, including Ernst Kantorowicz, who, ironically, was Jewish, repeated Rahmer's earlier rehabilitation of the Stauffers, who were celebrated as far-sighted empire builders. Kantorowicz's biography of Frederick II inspired Heinrich Himmler, while Hermann Göring sent Mussolini a copy. The Hitler Youth staged their flag dedication ceremony amidst the ruins of Hohenstaufen Castle in June 1933. Most professional historians were deeply conservative, and their studies of the empire's elective monarchy lent weight to the popular critique of Weimar democracy as pointless and divisive. The anti-Roman interpretation of the German past was consolidated in the so-called new constitutional history, pursued between the 1930s and 1970s by Theodor Meyer, Otto Brunner, Walter Schlesinger, and others, who tried to identify a specifically Germanic medieval socio-political organization, supposedly based on the personal elements of lordship, to define the pre-modern state as an aristocratic association of kings and nobles, Herrschaftsverband. Although adhering to the professional standards of German scholarship, their studies romanticized warrior nobles and provided ideal material for less scrupulous writers to extrapolate a theory of Germanic leader-follower society. Having seized power, the Nazis abolished the separate identities of Bavaria, Saxony, Württemberg, and other regions, replacing these on the 5th of February 1934 with a unitary nationality derived from racist criteria. The old political units, which often still used boundaries deriving from imperial fiefs, were replaced by new subdivisions called Gaue, a name associated with Germanic tribal homelands. Many Nazis found the Holy Roman past unusable. Joseph Goebbels planned an exhibition in Münster to demonstrate how the Peace of Westphalia had supposedly divided Germany, but abandoned this after the fall of France in 1940 eradicated the Nazis' sense of shame at their country's weak past. Hitler repeatedly used the Holy Roman Empire as a rhetorical counterpoint to his united Germany, parroting decades of conservative historical critique by, for instance, claiming that if the German feudal princes had been loyal to the German emperors, the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation would have become a mega empire. The Second Empire was commended for having briefly achieved national unity, but was otherwise condemned as a missed opportunity. A circular was sent to all Nazi Party organizations on the 13th of June 1939, banning further use of the adjective Third in reference to the Reich, since Hitler wished to avoid any comparisons with the two previous empires. The Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg was outspokenly hostile, dismissing the Holy Roman Empire as a tool of the papacy and trying to claim that the 4,500 Saxons executed by Charlemagne for refusing to convert to Christianity were precursors to Nazi fighters. For this, he was reprimanded by Hitler, who had a more heroic image of the Frankish king, who was, of course, a German. Hitler's intervention indicated the difficulties of ignoring the Holy Roman Empire altogether, if for no other reason than it encompassed so much of Germany's past. After the Anschluss with Austria in 1938, an SS honor guard was sent to fetch the imperial insignia from Vienna and escort them to Nuremberg, which had both been their location during early modernity and was now home to the Nazi Party headquarters. Although staged to symbolize the return of Austria, now dubbed the Ostmark, to Germany, the enterprise was problematic, since Charlemagne's crown was decorated with images of the Jewish kings David, Solomon, and Hezekiah. Himmler was perhaps the most enthusiastic of the senior leadership in appropriating the medieval empire to legitimate the new order. He chose July 1936, the 1,000th anniversary of the death of his Ottonian namesake Henry I, to inaugurate an annual Heinrichsfeier at Quedlinburg Castle for the SS. Like many of his contemporaries, Himmler was influenced by the 19th century misinterpretation of Henry as founder of a German empire. An SS division was named Hohenstaufen, while French SS volunteers formed another called Charlemagne in 1944. Karl Richard Ganser, the head of the Nazified National Historical Institute, celebrated a continuous Germanic imperial mission from Charlemagne to the present in a book that sold 850,000 copies soon after its appearance at the height of the German Blitzkrieg. Ganser's work appealed because it was simply a cruder version of what many Austrian historians and others like Friedrich Wilhelm Foerster had claimed since the 1920s, that the empire had provided order for Europe. The misuse and misunderstanding of history are perhaps best exemplified in the naming of the invasion of Russia. The general staff intended the banal code name Fritz, or Otto, but Hitler insisted on calling it Operation Barbarossa, probably because he regarded the emperor's crusading credentials as suitable for a mission to eradicate Bolshevism. Later 20th century perspectives. Nazi distortions had relatively little impact on the historical understanding of most Germans, who remained wedded to the conservative interpretations deriving from rancor and later 19th century scholarship. They continued to believe a medieval empire had existed until 1250, or possibly the reign of Charles V, and thought this had been a stabilizing Christian order, whereas the early modern empire was condemned as weak and responsible for delaying national greatness. These now traditional views survived Germany's total defeat in 1945 because they were shared by the victorious Allied powers. British, American, and French scholarship drew on the same detailed studies by 19th century German historians for their interpretative framework, not least because this had been transplanted by the numerous intellectuals fleeing Germany in the 1930s, who now held influential teaching posts in US universities. The new German Democratic Republic, established in 1949, had little interest in the empire, simply continuing 19th century interpretations repackaged within Marxist stadial history as the feudal age. Princely power supposedly triumphed over universal imperial policy by 1550, condemning Germany to political weakness and retarding economic development, which Marxist historiography attributed to centralizing national states. Meanwhile, the GDR government continued the Nazis' centralized state in a new form, reorganizing its territory into new districts, Bezirke, in a deliberate attempt to break lingering regional identities. Germany's partition between 1945 and 1990 assisted the Western Allies' project of deprussifying Germany, since the former Hohenzollern lands conveniently lay in the Soviet zone, including the rump of old Prussia that survives today as the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. Cold War historiography distinguished sharply between Western liberal traditions and alleged Eastern European authoritarianism. The standard interpretation of agrarian relations underpinned this with its model of a second serfdom developing east of the Elbe from the late Middle Ages. This political project did not challenge received wisdom about the Holy Roman Empire, since the conservative reading of German history unwittingly provided evidence to support Anglo-American interpretations of that country deviating from a Western liberal norm along its own special path to Hitler. Meanwhile, the West German Republic's federal structure reinvigorated regional history, as each of the new federal states, Bundesländer, established or revived historical commissions and journals dedicated to its area's history. Heraldic devices were borrowed from those of the leading principalities that had once existed within the boundary of each federal state. For example, modern Lower Saxony's use of the White Horse of Hanover. Detailed historical atlases and multi-volume regional studies all reinforced long-standing popular perceptions of the German past as consisting of a multitude of fragmented local histories in which medieval emperors might occasionally put in an appearance, but for which otherwise the empire was largely irrelevant. The word Reich was now indelibly tainted with Nazism, inhibiting the wider reception of the more positive scholarly reappraisal of the early modern empire underway since the late 1960s. Organizers of an exhibition on early modern Germany in Regensburg in 2000 deliberately avoided it, because they thought the public would confuse a reference to the Holy Roman Empire with Hitler's Germany or Bismarck's Second Empire. Exhibitions concentrated on displaying glittering medieval treasures and artworks rather than explaining how the empire had functioned. Already in 1946, the Allies returned the imperial insignia to Vienna from Nuremberg, where they had survived the war hidden in a bunker. West Germany's new federal parliament considered appealing in 1952 for their return, while Aachen's cathedral chapter insisted that the three items removed by Austrian troops in 1794 were holy relics that should be restored. Individual emperors remained fixed in public consciousness through their place in the school curriculum and depiction in popular TV dramas and documentaries, but perspectives remained stubbornly those of the 19th century. At best, the empire seemed harmless compared to Germany's more recent past. A 9-meter-high, 18-ton concrete figure was erected secretly one night in April 1993 on the stump of an old lighthouse in Konstanz's lakeside harbor. Designed by sculptor Peter Lenz, the figure is named Imperia. But unlike the pompous monuments of the Second Empire, this does not refer to the empire, but to a character in a story by Balzac, in turn loosely based on a courtesan who lived around a century after Konstanz hosted the famous church council. Probably the world's largest monument to a prostitute, Imperia is also representative of the 700 real courtesans who actually serviced the council. Turning every 3 minutes on her own axis, the voluptuous figure holds diminutive naked figures of Pope Martin V and Emperor Sigismund, identifiable primarily by their headgear, in the palm of each upturned hand, while her tiara resembles a medieval fool's hat, adding to the mockery of power. She remains the subject of continual objections from the Diocese of Freiburg and local conservative politicians. Yet the council is powerless to remove Imperia, because her location belongs to German Federal Railways, which part-financed her erection, while she has become a major tourist attraction. Throughout, controversy has focused on the apparent mockery of the papacy, whereas no one complains about a naked emperor. The Empire and the EU. The Europeanization of Imperial History. The scholarly reappraisal of the Empire since the late 1960s is representative of a broader Europeanization of German history, reconnecting with traditions till then denigrated as inferior to Teutonic Kultur. One aspect has involved examining previously neglected themes, especially in German political history, and has tended to view the Empire through the lens of the post-1949 German Federal Republic and its place in European integration. Another element has been to reinterpret the history of Europe's current states in less national terms. This has not progressed very far for the history of the Empire, which German historians are far more likely to refer to as of the German nation than were its actual inhabitants. In some respects, the Europeanization of the imperial past resembles the 19th century nationalist projects, especially in the way medieval history has been plundered for personalities and images that could be appropriated to articulate present-day agendas. Since 1977, several exhibitions have promoted the Stauffers as transnational European rulers whose empire incorporated regions of innovation, transmitting culture, trade, and ideas between Germany and Italy. Above all, Charlemagne has come to personify the links between the Empire and post-1945 aspirations for a united Europe, whereas other emperors, notably Charles V, remain viewed in national terms, even if these perspectives might now appear together in the same volume. Charlemagne's new European status owes much to the superficial coincidence between his actual empire and the space occupied by France, West Germany, Italy, and the Benelux countries behind initial post-war European integration. At a press conference in 1950, Charles de Gaulle presented Franco-German cooperation as picking up Charlemagne's project, this time on modern economic, social, strategic, and cultural grounds. Nationalists had found Charlemagne problematic by the 1870s, as he appeared too French for the Germans and too German for the French. Already in the 1840s, the French historian François Guizot seized on a 9th century sources presentation of Charlemagne as the father of Europe to claim the Franks were European. The annual Charlemagne Prize, inaugurated in Aachen in December 1949, as the new German Federal Republic's first political award, is explicitly intended to promote European integration. Aachen Cathedral was the first German monument to be designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site, 1978. The Empire as Model. Conservative politicians favoring European integration found the Empire an attractive model with which to underpin their arguments. The heir to the Habsburg throne, Otto von Habsburg, in his speeches and writings during the 1970s, drew on Austrian historiography of the 1920s and 1930s, which had already presented the medieval empire as a positive factor in ordering Europe, and which chimed with his contrast between democratic Western European countries and the godless communist Eastern Bloc. The imperial idea will rise again in the form of European unity. Although several leading historians of the empire have explicitly rejected such arguments, others openly present the early modern empire as a blueprint to create a Europe of the regions. These claims draw on the positive reappraisal of the early modern empire emerging from specialist studies published since 1967, and which some use to interpret it as polycentric, federal, and embodying the complementary division of responsibility between regions and the center that the European Commission calls subsidiarity. Further alleged parallels include the empire's conciliatory tendencies, its internal rule of law, and its tolerance of differing identities, which provided an ideal framework for flourishing and diverse cultures, whilst inhibiting the development of a modern nationalism that has spread so much evil across Europe and the world. The Council of Europe sponsored a major exhibition in Berlin and Magdeburg in 2006 to mark the bicentenary of the empire's dissolution. Opening the exhibition, the German culture minister Bernd Neumann presented the medieval empire as a model of a functioning suprastate order. In the run-up to the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome the following year, Neumann referred to the empire as a model for the EU. Pope Benedict XVI drew similar parallels based on an oddly upbeat reading of medieval church-state relations. At least such statements have the merit of presenting the empire in terms that make it intelligible to a wider public, by contrast with the stress on complexity, exceptions and qualifications that otherwise characterizes modern scholarship. Making a subject relevant to the contemporary world is increasingly important as public funding becomes restricted to research that can demonstrate practical impact. However, two significant problems emerge. Despite record attendances at the recent exhibitions, the older negative narratives retain their grip on the broader public understanding of the empire. Europeans still generally conceive their past through the prism of 19th century nation-states, and are often encouraged to do so by conservative governments and education policies. The past remains a road to modernity, with some routes rated better than others, according to a common yardstick still largely defined by the national sovereign state. This can have direct political repercussions, as the German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer discovered in spring 2000, when he compared an expanded EU without institutional reform to the late phase of the Holy Roman Empire. Fischer's understanding of the empire was still the weak structure presented by older historiography. But the French Interior Minister, Jean-Pierre Chevènement, read the reference to Reich to mean that Germans wanted to remove European nation-states in order to establish a new imperial dominance over the continent. Several leading German historians have also expressed alarm at their colleagues' equation of the empire with the EU, believing this could stir latent fears of German hegemonic ambitions and mean that German enthusiasm for Europe will be misinterpreted as a cloak for German national interests. Beyond the potential for misunderstanding, there is a second problem of how the empire's history might actually help understand some of the problems facing today's Europe. Since the 2004 enlargement and 2008 economic crisis, opinion on the EU has divided ever more sharply into two camps. One advocates forging a closer political union, including making the European Parliament a more effective democratic body. Older negative assessments of the empire provide ammunition for these arguments. Like Fischer, the British historian Brendan Sims has compared the unreformed EU to the empire, claiming both are characterized by interminable and inconclusive debate. Echoing Hamilton and Madison's equally dim assessment of 1787, Sims argues that the EU should become the United States of Europe along Anglo-American lines, subordinating its member states to a fully federal system, whilst reforming the European Parliament to provide a democratic mandate for a new common government. The counterargument is provided by nationalists like those in the UK Independence Party, UKIP, who believe that the EU can never match the vitality of sovereign states, both as governments and as foci for identity. For them, current problems can only be solved by reducing the Union to a free trade area, or dissolving it entirely. Although arriving at opposite conclusions, both perspectives are bound by the same understanding of the state as a single, centralized monopoly of legitimate power over a recognized territory. This definition is a European invention, retrospectively backdated to the Peace of Westphalia, and used to articulate an international order based on mutually recognized sovereign states. Such states are supposedly hermetically sealed containers, with their populations free to decide internally how they are governed, whilst acting internationally with one voice through their national government. While this still underpins organizations like the United Nations, it is increasingly unlikely that such states are political history's final destination. Wide aspects of daily and national life are clearly beyond the effective control of most governments, which are increasingly vulnerable to global economic, popular, technological, and environmental forces. Imperial History as Guide for Today's Issues. EU enlargement has been interpreted as hegemonic imperialism, acting in the manner of 19th century European colonialism by imposing its own norms and standards of civilization on those it admits as new members. This perspective is close to the nationalist critique of the EU as a union that imposes an unwelcome uniformity on its citizens, smothering rather than liberating them. However, many Europeans regard their own national governments as more immediately oppressive than the European Commission, and feel they would be better off without them. In September 2014, the United Kingdom only narrowly avoided fragmentation when the Scots voted in a referendum against independence. It is far from clear that recovery of national sovereignty along the lines advocated by UKIP and its equivalents in other countries would restore citizens' confidence in national governments, controlled largely by colorless politicians, widely criticized for being out of touch with local and individual needs. There is considerable concern at a democracy deficit throughout the Western world, where disillusionment with the political process is leading to self-disenfranchisement, manifest through dwindling voter turnout and widespread cynicism. Several attempts to address this have described the EU as a neo-medieval empire, arguing that it is not converging along the Westphalian model into a federal superstate, but is evolving instead as a complex structure of fragmented sovereignty and plurilateral governance. The concept of neo-medievalism is an analytical construct that would benefit from closer engagement with the actual history of the Holy Roman Empire, at least during its last three centuries. Comparisons can be instructive, if not necessarily flattering, to either the EU or the Empire. First, the Empire's history is a reminder that decentralized political systems are not necessarily peaceful in their intentions. Like the Empire, the EU does not possess its own armed forces, nor has it waged wars, yet decentralization ensures a significant proportion of wealth continues to be spent on defense, as each member remains fully armed. The EU has remained at peace, but individual member states, such as France and the UK, have been involved in several wars and other substantial military operations, not all of them clearly sanctioned by the UN or any other multilateral organization. Although celebrated in the more positive scholarly interpretations as having peaceful intentions, the 18th century empire was the most heavily armed part of Europe, and it proved incapable of preventing individual members, such as Austria or Saxony, from waging their own wars outside its frontiers. Both the EU and the Empire have lacked a single capital or a clear political core. Although individual elements have enjoyed more influence than others, This did not result in subjugation, except in the final stages of the empire after 1801. The EU displays clear differences from the empire in that its members retain the formal legal equality accorded to sovereign states. This extends to special cultural provisions, such as ensuring official documentation is prepared in all national languages, as well as equal freedom of movement for citizens, goods, and capital. By contrast, autonomy in the empire was embedded in a hierarchy defined by status and differing constitutional rights. However, the EU struggles to reconcile formal equality with the considerable diversity in population, wealth, and economic potential across its membership, as evidenced by the repeated revisions to voting arrangements in its central institutions. It also shares the empire's imprecision around frontiers, which remain only superficially defined by national boundaries. Member states are combined in different overlapping levels of jurisdiction, such as the Schengen Border Agreement, the Eurozone, and the EU itself. Additionally, individual members have binding commitments to states outside the Union, such as the UK's leadership of the Commonwealth, just as early modern Austria and Prussia had extensive hereditary possessions outside the empire. The EU further resembles the empire in lacking an organized uniform body of citizens. Its relationship to its inhabitants is indirect and mediated by autonomous political levels, such as the member states, which can still set their own criteria for citizenship, yet issue passports conferring rights extending across the entire Union. The empire appears to have done rather better than the EU in fostering attachment amongst its inhabitants, who valued it as a framework sustaining local and particular liberties and in respecting diversity, autonomy, and difference. It is here that perhaps the most interesting comparisons can be made. Sovereignty is fragmented in the EU, as it was in the empire. In both, policy implementation depends on members' cooperation, allowing scope for local adaptation and initiative. These arrangements require consensus to a far higher extent than in centralized sovereign polities, including federal ones like the United States, where central institutions, for example Congress, act directly on citizens through their ability to pass laws affecting their lives, tax their wealth, or conscript them as soldiers. It is precisely this arrangement that appears threatened by voter apathy and disenchantment, because citizens risk losing control of the institutions of government. By contrast, decentralized, fragmented political structures do not lend themselves to common direct democratic control, as evidenced by the European Parliament's struggle to find a meaningful role within the EU and in the minds of European voters. Some political scientists now argue that decentralized, fragmented systems might offer different, perhaps even better ways to forge consensus by legitimation through deliberation. Decentralized structures can spread authority, creating multiple, more local and thereby perhaps more meaningful arenas for decisions to be reached. Consensus becomes a more open-ended, ongoing process of bargaining between interested parties, rather than a periodic assignment of mandates to elected representatives expected to agree definitive decisions. Democratic legitimacy derives from the openness of debate, not the practice of voting. Citizenship is about involvement in and access to discussion through civil society and a free media, not simply formal rights and institutions. It seems likely that, for such ideas to work, participants must accept that politics can no longer be guided by absolutes, rather in the manner that conflict resolution in the empire was about workable compromises, not questions of right or wrong. Like current practice within the EU, the empire relied on peer pressure, which was often more effective and less costly than coercion, and which functioned thanks to the broad acceptance of the wider framework and a common political culture. However, our review of the empire has also revealed that these structures were far from perfect and could fail, even catastrophically. Success usually depended on compromise and fudge. Although outwardly stressing unity and harmony, the empire in fact functioned by accepting disagreement and disgruntlement as permanent elements of its internal politics. Rather than providing a blueprint for today's Europe, the history of the empire suggests ways in which we might understand current problems more clearly. This concludes Heart of Europe by Peter H. Wilson, narrated by Napoleon Ryan. Copyright 2016 by Peter H. Wilson. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Penguin Random House UK and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.